With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here.
We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to the May 5th webcast from the Kentucky Water Fuel Museum. We have a very special guest this evening, George Wiseman of Eagle Research. And George, you are with us.
Yes.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
It's a great privilege to have you. I consider you one of the foremost experts in the world on water as fuel technology.
And well, that does a lot to my ego, so I guess
well,
I'll try
it's
to
true.
Be modest.
The fact is I'm looking at a four-page yellow pamphlet that highlights some of the publications and DVDs that you have produced that the public can order from your website, which I might as well go ahead and mention that. That's eagle-research.com, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, eagle-research.com.
Yep.
And I'll just read a little mission statement that you have here at the beginning of this little leaflet. It says, Eagle Research develops and distributes practical energy solutions. And then it says things that are simple, inexpensive, environmentally considerate, easy to build, low maintenance, and applicable to small-scale energy needs. Well, what a beautiful statement that is.
Yeah, that's we actually should revise that, as it is a little too wordy. Somebody has pointed out recently to me, but it comes from my background. The whole idea of how I became an inventor and all that sort of thing.
Well, why don't we get into that? You were born in the U.S., but then your family moved to Canada when you were a teenager, correct?
That's correct. Yep, I was born in Missoula, Montana, which I love and my wife loves too. We go back there quite often. Montana is one of those special states. Anyway, and Missoula is a special city.
I'm familiar with Missoula. My sister lives there.
Oh, yeah, okay. So
yeah, it is very beautiful. I've enjoyed skiing the mountains around there, too.
Excellent. Okay, so then my father was going to forestry college at the time there, and we moved kind of all over the United States, including living in Alaska for 4 years, because he worked for the BLM. And in the end, as he was going on trips, he was going through British Columbia, and he found this beautiful ranch where you could buy land for like $2,000 for a quarter section, like 180 acres.
Wow.
And so he bought several sections and put them together, like five different mini ranches, and made a bigger ranch. And unfortunately, in the middle of B.C. at that time, and that was about 1974, we actually moved to B.C., and I was about 14 years old, there was no electricity. And in fact, there was no electricity there until it got to be just when I was moving away. I was 19 years old and I was leaving home. And that's when we got electricity into the houses and ranch houses and stuff. So there was no plumbing, there was no running water, there was no electricity. We were living in the 1920s type environment back in the bush of British Columbia.
Amazing.
Yeah.
What an experience for a young person.
Well, the thing is, when you're a young person, what there is what there is. You don't know, right?
Yeah. Well, you've become accustomed to the conveniences as a teenager in Montana, right?
Well, the thing is, we really didn't have TV at any time because our family really didn't believe in it, my parents. And we always lived on the outskirts. So we knew what electricity was, and we had lights and running water and that kind of thing when I was very young. But once we moved to the ranch, like my youngest brother and sister, there were seven of us in the family, my youngest ones really didn't have any memory of that. That's what, they just grew up that way. And I just adapted. I was the oldest, and then my next youngest sisters and brothers were just adapted to this. But, yeah, we knew what it was, and eventually CB radios became the rage, and there was chains where you could communicate to town because there was no phones either. That was way before cell phones.
Wow, yeah.
And so you could communicate to town via one neighbor telling the next one what there was and the next one telling that one until you could get a message into town to get something or something. You know, it's like,
although it could be distorted by the time it reached town, huh?
Yeah, they were pretty good. They were pretty good. And it was only for emergencies if it was something like that in that kind of case.
Well, how do you like that? And you feel that this was a major impact on your later life as far as your pursuit of alternative energy?
Yes, exactly. Because as I grew up, and I did have some idea what it was about, electricity, well, you go to school, right? And school had everything. But at home, we still had outhouses and lanterns and fireplace or stoves where we burned wood to heat and what have you. So I'm almost an anachronism in this modern society. But as I grew up there, I of course, took all the math, physics, chemistry, everything. I didn't do biology, but everything with the physical sciences that I could, because it just fascinated me, and I'm exceptionally good at it. So the I have quite an aptitude, so it was easy. It sucked it up. I got all my mechanics. I'm an automotive technician, certified now, but I'm also qualified electronics, plumbing, carpentry, just a whole range of everything. So anyway, because when you grow up on a ranch like that, everything, you have to do it yourself. You just have to do it yourself. We were 80 miles from a vet. So if an animal got sick, you essentially fixed it yourself or you died.
Yeah.
The animal died, you know?
Well, I think that's part of the beauty of the settling of this country by the Europeans and the kind of ingenuity that had to accompany the settling of this ground, and all the homesteads that existed across the country, and how the average farmer was definitely a do-it-yourselfer.
Exactly. And in fact, the farms have almost, they built my business, if you will. When I was back in the mail order business, farms knew mail order. All farms did mail order. So when it was mail order business, and I was selling my books via mail order, then the do-it-yourselfers tended to be the farmers, and so it was the rural areas that mostly took up my technologies back in the 80s. And
well, let's get to that beginning, too. Now, we've talked about your early life, and then you're studying the sciences.
Mm-hmm.
It was in 1984 you began Eagle Research, or was it called that then? Or
yeah, that's when it actually officially became Eagle Research. I was obviously inventing before that. An interesting little side story, there was this girl that I really liked, and I decided I needed to have some money in order to attract her attention. And I figured either I had to be a prospector or an inventor to make enough money. This is a farmer boy thinking, you know?
Yeah.
And so I kind of went along both lines, and I have a prospector's license as well, and have some interesting stories that direction. But the inventing thing, I've always just wanted to build things better. I like machines that work. I like simplicity. I do not like things to break down. I like to be able to do what I'm doing and not have the machines break. So there's lots of stories on that as well. But as I was inventing things and actually decided to be an inventor for income, I was able to develop something called the carburetor enhancer, which was my first actual practical invention that was mine. I ended up inventing a lot of things before that I eventually then found were already on the shelf, quite often better than I had invented them. So, but the first time that I found something that was leading edge out to the point where eventually, of course, I found that even the carburetor enhancer had been developed by the car companies, but had been refused to be put on the vehicles. There was only one version of police vehicle that they actually put it on. Every other vehicle they didn't have. But I can prove they did have the technology. And what I did then was able to make that particular technology, which for $15 worth of parts, you could modify any downdraft carburetor to get a minimum of 25% increase in mileage.
And how was it accomplishing that?
Well, fuel only burns when it's in a vapor form. Liquid fuel doesn't burn. So you need to get as much of the fuel into a vapor form as possible. The way a carburetor does that is it atomizes the fuel into small little droplets, using the Venturi and vacuum effects, the dispersion. Inside the carburetor, there's a what they call air bleeds. And the air bleeds in a downdraft carburetor are specifically designed to prevent the fuel from siphoning out of the float bowl into the intake manifold when it isn't being required. Incidentally, it also adds a little bit of air into the fuel mixture so that it ends frothing the mixture just a little bit. So when the fuel is spraying out into the Airstream is actually spraying as a spray instead of a gush. The carburetor enhancer enhances that air bleed action. A spray of fuel, by the way, then has a lot more surface area than just a gush like coming out of a garden hose.
Right.
And therefore, a lot more of the fuel can contact the air and evaporate and turn into vapor. And the main thing you're looking for is to get the fuel into a vapor form for efficient combustion of the fuel. The carburetor enhancer, what it does is it puts a slight vacuum on the float bowl, which holds back some of the fuel, which causes more air to go in a ratio, more air to go in the air bleed, and it enhances that frothing action, which then turns that spray into the Venturi more into a mist spraying into the Venturi. And a mist, very much smaller droplets, has a lot more surface area than a spray, and of course then there's even more evaporation and more of the fuel is ready to burn when the spark plug fires.
Very interesting. And it was actually utilized in police vehicles, huh?
Yes, because it increases power as well as economy, and the police vehicles needed both of that in order to complete with the fuel injection systems that were coming out at the time. This was in
the
mid-70s.
How can you explain the automakers not using it across the board?
That is the $6 trillion question.
Can I take it you used that figure?
In the United States, in the mid-70s, when I checked last, the energy monopolies, I call them, were making about $6 trillion a year in North America. Now, that doesn't count all the rest of the world and what have you, and North America is using about 30% of the energy that's used everywhere. So that gives you a bit of an idea of how much energy is sold in the world. And a significant portion of that is fuel. If you're able to reduce the fuel consumption by even 10%, you're taking billions and billions of dollars out of somebody's pocket. And where the money goes, where the trail goes, is where people should be really paying attention, because then you can start to see things and know what's really happening out there. But in any case, yes, that's the kind of thing.
Well, I noticed a quotation that I think it is appropriate to mention at this time. In the back of one of your publications, there was just a one-line quote from Roy McAllister of the American Hydrogen Association, in which he said basically what you just said, but he said that if the fuel efficiency of our vehicles were improved by just, I think he said 1% or 2% or something, it would result in saving 1 billion gallons of fuel a day. Something like that.
Yeah, I haven't run that math, but it'd be relatively simple to do because the information is now readily available on the Internet how much fuel every country uses, not just the United States.
But what it caused me to think of is the economic value of that fuel and how the people that sell fuel certainly would not want to lose the sale of 1 billion gallons of their product in a day.
Absolutely not.
So fuel efficiency is really something that has been stifled throughout the decades of the 20th century and on till today.
And has made a significant change in, like, these policies these people have made a significant change in the well-being of everyone on the planet.
Yeah.
You are probably aware that the United States has a very poor reputation out there right now. And that's a direct result of carrying on little mini-wars in several different countries. And the reason that they're carrying on in several of these countries is because of oil. And the reason that they're going after the oil is because over 50% of the oil is imported into the United States. So it's costing the United States over $1 billion a day, to maintain these offshore actions, where if that $1 billion was put into something as simple as the carburetor enhancer, that it's $15 per vehicle, and it would save more fuel than they need to import.
Yeah, that's the amazing thing.
You see,
when you start talking about wholesale reduction in fuel consumption, then it changes the dynamic of this need for foreign oil altogether.
Exactly, and that's one of the points I'm trying to get out there. I'm going to be making a few more facts and what have you in my e-newsletters and stuff. But
I noticed that you're realistic. In one of the publications I was looking at, you mentioned that for someone to expect that the world is going to make a sudden change to such a thing as water fuel, it ain't going to happen. And so there needs to be some transition efforts made, such as hydrogen boosters, such as you, a lot of your work is dedicated to promoting the use of a hydrogen booster under the hood of a gasoline engine vehicle. Maybe we can get into that, but let's just back up a little bit more. So you started Eagle Research with this carburetor enhancer device, is that correct?
That was the first actual thing that actually put Eagle Research on in the black.
And you were selling it as a kit or just plans to build one yourself?
The very first thing was plans, and that ended up, and it's kind of an interesting story. I accidentally discovered the carburetor enhancer because as I was experimenting on a fuel evaporation device called the HYCO 2A, which is another good device that we have, but it's for carbureted vehicles. So you, people who have fuel-injected vehicles should be looking at the Hyzer, just as a side note. But as I was experimenting with the HYCO 2A, my wife's vehicle that I was using to drive back and forth to mechanics college at the time, which was about 100 kilometers to go to this college, worked out to be, I was getting, let's see, it was somewhere in the order of about a 60% increase in economy using the HYCO 2A.
And again, but the HYCO 2A is a
fuel evaporator.
Okay.
So essentially what I was telling you about the carburetor where you're spraying a fuel into the airstream.
Right.
What the HYCO 2A does is reverse that and actually pull the air through the fuel. So the air has maximum, it's bubbling it through the fuel, it has maximum air-fuel contact. So you're evaporating a huge amount of gasoline and much more than a carburetor alone can do. But that's kind of beside the point of what we're talking about now. It's a little story I wanted to tell. With the carburetor enhancer, obviously if you're pulling fuel in from another source, think of it as another carburetor, then you have to cut back on the fuel from the carburetor you have. So I, just because I'm a mechanic, I knew that if you put a vacuum in the float bowl of the carburetor, it would hold the fuel there. It wouldn't allow the fuel to go into the engine. And yet the float bowl of the carburetor would still be completely full. As soon as you remove that vacuum, you'd have instant power, right? So what I was able to, that's what I originally built what I now call a carburetor enhancer for, is to hold fuel back in the regular carburetor so that as the fuel vapors were going in from my other fuel source, I wasn't getting too rich of a mixture because fuel coming in from two sources.
Right.
So I had this nice balancing act going because as the vacuum increased, it would pull more vapors from the HYCO 2A, and a higher vacuum would hold back more fuel in the carburetor using a carburetor enhancer. Because of early versions of any experiment, my HYCO 2A container would develop issues, which I have completely solved years ago, but I always had to be very careful, because it was my wife's car, to make sure that at any time when I wasn't driving it, she wouldn't be having any issues. Everything had to be able to shut off properly.
Yeah.
So whenever there was an issue, I would shut it off, and in this one particular day, I always keep track of my fuel economy. I just have since I was a young boy. There's a story behind that too.
Not having any money.
I found that I was still getting a 30% over baseline with my HYCO 2A shut off, and I was wondering what the heck. And then I realized I hadn't shut off the vacuum to the carburetor float bowl, and that's where the carburetor enhancer was actually officially born. There was another experiment earlier, about 5 or 6 years earlier, where I'd accidentally done something but never realized what I did, and then when I thought back, I was able to figure that it was actually the carburetor enhancer again. So there are particular carburetors, Ford 2150s, which mostly double their mileage with the carburetor enhancer because they have the highest efficient air bleed system. It all has to do with the air bleed system. Again, any vacuum in any carburetor float bowl will hold the fuel back, but it doesn't necessarily increase the efficiency of the carburetor. That all has to do with how it interacts with the air bleed system. So there's a bunch of Hollies, for example, which you get a minimum gain, like 10 or 15% kind of thing, because they have a rudimentary air bleed system. But these motorcraft 2150s, for example, they were just before they went to fuel injection system,
right?
And they had the most sophisticated air bleed systems because they were trying to compete the best they could with the fuel injection systems, and the carburetor enhancer works exceptionally well on those.
Wow. Well, let's go on from there then. So you started out with gasoline improvement technologies.
Right.
And then how did you get introduced to Brown's gas or oxyhydrogen?
Well, there's an interim thing there where I'm making money selling combustion enhancement technology because I was always interested in that. And again, there's a whole. I was always interested in getting farther on a gallon of gas because when I lived on a ranch, as you know, and when I got my pickup truck, my dad would give me only one tank full of fuel a week. So I had to get as far as I could on it, and I had my girlfriend lived in town, so there was incentive to get as far as I could on my gallon of gas.
Yeah.
And I, in a 1966 Ford pickup truck with a 361 industrial engine, I was getting up to 32 miles to the gallon.
Wow.
And that was just tuning it. That wasn't any of this additional stuff that I'm talking about here. That was just making the drivetrain and carburetion system as efficient as possible.
And what size engine again?
That was a 361.
A 351 Windsor?
No, a 361.
A 361, okay.
That's right. It was the industrial version of the 360.
Huh.
I used to love going to places that filled up oil for a set fee, like $15 or something, oil change.
Yeah.
Because they'd be putting oil in this thing. It had like a 9-quart oil pan. And they'd be going, ka-choo, 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 ka-choo. And they'd look under the car, a truck, to see if it was leaking out.
That's hilarious.
No, yeah, it was a very powerful version of the 360. And because of that, I was able to put like a 2-to-1 ratio rear end in the truck, and I would idle at about 700 or 800 RPM at 50-60 miles an hour.
Huh! Amazing.
Yeah.
So that contributed to the fuel efficiency, also then.
Of course, yeah.
But still, that's phenomenal.
Yeah.
30-some miles per gallon, and even was that even hauling a load? Were you experiencing?
No, actually, that was just going at say 45-50 miles an hour on the flat.
Yeah.
If I really booted it, I went 70, even 90 miles an hour. In fact, I have stories of ridiculousness, which I won't say on air. But even at 70 miles an hour, I could get over 25 miles per gallon with that setup.
That's amazing.
And because of the high ratios and the way the torque of the engine was, I couldn't spin rubber with the truck. But at 50 miles an hour, I could go to 90 just about in the blink of an eye.
Huh, amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, so then what?
And of course, that was before I really started studying this combustion enhancement. That was just doing the best I could in my dad's shop. In fact, when we bought the ranch, the first thing he did before he even set up a house for Mom, he built this big shop because we had to maintain all the farm equipment and stuff, eh?
Sure.
Okay, so I'm sorry. Go ahead with your question again.
Yeah, so then from 1984, selling plans for a carburetor enhancer, then when did water become an interest to you?
Okay, around about that time, it was an interest because of Gene Stowe's systems. Are you familiar with him?
No.
Okay. He invented something which eventually called the hydrogen gas system, which has morphed into several different things. It was Integra Drive, all those kind of things over the years. But generally, he had a relatively sophisticated onboard electrolyzer back in the 70s. And he has, I've got a file about 4 inches thick of testimonials and all kinds of things that were happening back then, but it was kind of before the time when people really cared because the fuel was still relatively inexpensive then, right?
This was before the oil embargo?
No, it was actually during the time of the oil embargo, but then fuel got cheap again, right?
Okay.
So he got a boost at that point, but then it just kind of died.
Yeah. The interest died. That's the problem.
That's right. That's correct. The interest died. So now, because the fuel is high-priced again, the interest is there. So, and additionally, now there's interest in saving the environment, whereas before there wasn't.
Yeah.
So what we have is, I always had a bit of a sideline on that, but I was mostly in trying to get as much of the fuel into a vapor form as possible. And my ultimate achievement, my brother and I built a carburation system, a fuel system, that actually cracked the fuel. You put a gasoline in the gas tank, but it was actually methane that was burning in the engine. And because of the way that it cracked the fuel using catalytic action and heat from the exhaust and all these kind of things, I outlined the system in my Extreme Mileage 101 book, but I have it cost us, I calculated it would cost $16,000 to build each carburation system.
Wow.
And I have pictures of it. I don't know if they're on the internet right now, but it's... There were pipes and tubes. I essentially had a mini catalytic cracking plant under the hood.
Yeah, like a refinery, huh?
A little mini refinery. There were 16 gauges on the dash. I needed a co-pilot to drive the truck.
Wow.
That one person operated the little mini refinery, and the other person actually drove.
Yeah, obviously it wasn't practical for the average consumer.
That's correct. However, we did ultimately discover all of these principles that we were then able to start developing something that wasn't as efficient as that. We got well over 200 miles per gallon. In fact, we never really was able to figure out exactly how much it was able to do, because most of the time we would drive all day and we'd open up the fuel tank to put more gas in to figure out and gas would pour out.
Amazing. You actually had more volume of gas after driving?
Yes. It's just a quirk of how fuel reacts during the heat of the day, right? Because
yeah.
I would put the fuel in on essentially an empty tank in the morning, it'd be cool, and then when I drove all day, it'd been heating up and what have you, and then when I take the gas cap off, and I'd driven hundreds of miles.
Boy, what an encouraging thing to open the cap and find that you not only haven't used any, but you've got more than you started with.
So in any case, I later figured out that I should have just used a little mini tank, like a pint or something, to be able to...
But you were basically doing something similar to the Pogue carburetor, but a different approach.
That's correct. The Pogue carburetor in the 1940s, back in that time, was a perfectly good carburetor. But if you put today's fuel in it, you'd only get about 30 miles per gallon. And
yeah.
They definitely were getting over 200 miles per gallon with that carburetor. If you distilled the fuel, like what they were using, distilled fuel, you'd still get it. But what happens is today's fuel is a mixture of about 4,000 different fuels because they're using a cracking process instead of a distillation process. So you actually needed to have a different kind of a carburetor which would handle all of the different spectrum of fuels, not just the pressures and enthalpies and what have you, one particular fuel, which his was tuned to one particular fuel.
Right.
So
thus they complicated the system to where you couldn't easily do what he did.
That's right. So we did invent a system that would do that and take care of all the different fuels. It would crack all the fuels and then ended up burning and converted it all into methane or natural gas, as either way you want to look at it. And then, of course, had the metering system. It was quite amazing. That particular truck, I had a little tiny needle valve to actually meter the fuel into the engine. It was an oxygen control valve, like when you have a breathing apparatus for people, oxygen-assisted breathing,
right.
A little stainless steel needle valve. And a quarter turn open, the truck would run, but it would, like quarter turn open from right closed, the truck would run. It was a 292, inline six. The truck would run, but with very little power. Half turn open, it would run with normal power. You wouldn't know there was any difference from a normal carburation system. Three quarters turn open, and I had a hot rod.
Huh.
It could burn rubber, no problem.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And this is strictly controlling the intake air with that?
We had to control the intake air as well as the fuel. It had to be a proper air-fuel mixture.
But that what you're talking about, that needle valve was controlling the...
No. The needle valve was just part of the, call it the carburation system. That wasn't actually the throttle and final control of the air-fuel system.
Uh-huh.
That was... when the gas was cracked into the methane,
yes,
that was how much methane was being allowed into the final expansion chamber, which then built up a little bit of a pressure so that I'd have like 4 psi pressure that I could meter into the engine as required.
Wow. So in other words, you're saying the fuel requirement is considerably less than what would normally be viewed as necessary, say, if you were using propane or gasoline vapor or something?
That's correct. Considerably less. What's happening... And I explain it in the extreme mileage. There's even some details in the fuel saver log that we have. But there's it tells how you can get like 10 gallons of fuel from 1 gallon of fuel, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the cracking process, you end up with a whole lot more fuel than you would have otherwise had. And I won't go into all those details right at the moment. We're kind of talking about water as fuel today.
Yes.
But in any case, going through that phase, I was on the side always working with the hydrogen assist because it was a way to increase the efficiency of fossil fuel burning. I'm not sure if most people are aware, but gasoline actually requires a trace amount of water, moisture of some sort, or it will not even burn. It won't burn at all. If there is no moisture, if it's totally dry, even if it's in a vapor form, it won't burn.
Really?
Yes.
Most
people don't know that.
In an absolute non-humid environment, you can't get gasoline to burn?
That's correct.
Amazing.
it requires that little bit. Now, there's probably ways it can happen if you put a big enough spark or enough and that sort of thing. But in a normal combustion situation, in normal combustion environments, you require a trace amount of moisture. Now, that trace amount of moisture, it turns out, is very specific. You can't just dump water in there, or you can, but it doesn't necessarily enhance the combustion. There's certain kinds of moisture which enhance the combustion better, which ended up being, as I learned this, we invented the Hizor eventually, and so I'll get to that in a little bit.
So then you're talking about water injection,
Deliberately injecting water is a good thing to do in an internal combustion engine and should be in every internal combustion engine. And one of the main reasons I believe that they don't do it is because water freezes in the wintertime. But but it definitely increases the efficiency of combustion in several different ways.
Yeah. Well, and of course, they have used it for decades, even during World War II, in the fighter jets, or fighter planes, rather.
Right.
They use it to increase the power of the engines, right?
That's right. Exactly. So we're as I was going along in about 1990, I learned about Brown's gas, and the machines that I wanted that were available for sale at that time were about $100,000 each.
Brown's gas, for those who aren't familiar, is named after Yul Brown, the Australian or Bulgarian Australian immigrant who developed what he named after himself, Brown's gas, hydrogen oxygen gas from water.
Right. So you're splitting water using relatively normal electrolysis system. The thing that was unique about it was that they weren't separating the hydrogen and oxygen. The hydrogen and oxygen were all kept together and went out the same hose.
And even being compressed in a tank.
Not really. If you try to compress this mixture you can compress it mildly.
Yes.
But if you compress it very much, it will self-explode.
So he was allowing the gas to be compressed from his electrolyzer to the tune of, what, 60 psi or something?
You can do 60, 70, maybe in certain circumstances even up to 100 psi. We don't do more than 8 psi in our machines.
Yeah, it's not necessary.
That's correct. It's because it's not necessary, and because as you compress the gas, it increases the density of the gas, and if you have an explosion inside, the density increases the sharpness of the explosion, and so you're much more likely to rupture containers if you have a higher pressure. The higher the pressure you go, the more force the explosion has.
So he was pushing the envelope, but he did it in a scientific manner.
He wasn't being foolhardy. No, he did. He had an amazing amount of knowledge about what he was doing there. He spent 30 years at it.
And I think he even boasted that he never had an unwanted explosion in all the years of his research.
I think if he said that, then he was, then he had some explosions which put holes in his roof, which I have pictures of.
Well, maybe what he meant is
he wanted
a cylinder explode. Maybe that's what it is.
Okay. It was an interesting thing. You probably heard of Christopher Berg.
As in?
He did some really nice reports on what Yul Brown is doing, Fire from Water, in Explore magazine.
Oh, really?
A couple of years before he and then eventually Yul Brown died. But the...
Yeah, I think I do have his articles. I do, yes.
Right. And in one of those articles, it describes his shop and how the holes were in the ceiling and stuff like that. So I had a couple holes in my ceiling, too.
Yeah. Well, it's better that they be in the ceiling than they be in your head, you know.
Well, this is true.
A good thing your head's not in the way when the hole's made in the ceiling. Because it would be very interesting. Yeah, that is something to emphasize, that people should not think that somehow, because hydrogen is non-toxic and so on, that it's also safe to be playing with. It isn't.
Well, it's a combustible gas, just
yeah.
like acetylene or gasoline or any other.
So there are earth-friendly aspects of hydrogen-oxygen gas, but at the same time, as you say, it is combustible, and therefore it is not to be played with as if it's harmless.
Exactly. In fact, the hydrogen in a comparison study ends up being safer than most other gases, largely because it doesn't concentrate, for example, and therefore any explosion, even though it's sharp, is relatively mild, and it is lighter than air. Where most other combustible gases are heavier than air, settle down into pockets and can make explosive pockets, where hydrogen dissipates in the air almost instantly and becomes non-explosive.
Exactly. Yeah, so there are many many positive aspects to using this fuel. Every time I hear of a fiery crash, which we seem to have around here every month, someone dies in a fiery car crash or, you know, plane crash or whatever, and I think, you know, if people were using water as fuel, that would be a thing of the past.
For the most part. Obviously, there's a lot of different ways of using water as fuel. You're probably aware of quite a few of them. You have there, I'm assuming, a copy of my Water as Fuel book 1, Research
Yes.
Assistant, in which I give about 13 different ways that water has been used as a fuel over the last 100 years or so. And we are then taking each different way and turning it into an actual manual where people can do something like with the Heiser technology. But we're getting a little ahead of ourselves. We, back in the early 1990s, I discovered Brown's gas, and as an inventor, just looking at my notes here. The reason I call it Brown's gas, as you said, from Ewell Brown, is to honor Ewell Brown, his 30 years of research. As an inventor, I like to, first of all, get a common name for something. Okay, the Brown's gas is also known as green gas, HHO gas, Rhodes gas, hydroxy. There's a whole bunch of different names for Brown's gas. It's all exactly the same stuff. William Rhodes in Phoenix, Arizona, actually had the first patent, predating by 10 years Ewell Brown's work, where he did the what he called the single-ducted gas, where he made electrolyzers that had the same with the gas, the hydrogen, oxygen coming out the same hose. And once I learned about William Rhodes and went to visit him, we got along so well that he actually allowed me to take and copy his research notes. And I have them. And his research notes virtually, the other way around, excuse me, he predated me. My research notes virtually are identical to his. We developed the technology in almost exactly the same manner.
Wow.
He did it 40 years before me. So but I did it independently, and then we got along famously. It's like he's an amazing fellow, and last time I talked to him, he was 95 years old. And
he is still alive.
Yeah, as far as I know, he's still alive. He was sharp as a tack and still as a paid advisor to NASA.
Well, I'd love to have him as a guest.
Yes, William Rhodes, Phoenix, Arizona, he'd be an amazing guest for you.
Yeah. Well, I know someone went to go visit him recently. One of my other guests from a few weeks back went to go see him, and I never did hear how that visit went. But so he is still alive at this time. I would love to talk to him. But what was his background? He was a physicist, wasn't he?
He is a physicist, yeah.
Yeah. So when he did this research, the results were a water torch. Is that not so?
Yes. The company that he started, along with his partners, Hennis Corporation, is actually still in business, but it's gone through several ownership changes and stuff like that. And so Brown's gas has actually been around on the marketplace for over 50 years. And those particular machines did a lot of work with jewelers. Any jeweler could get a hold of one of these machines actually had competitive advantage over anything else, because compared to acetylene and what have you, Brown's gas just outperforms it hands down, which comes to why I got into Brown's gas to begin with, was because I wanted a torch that was better than acetylene. I had heard that you could weld plastic to titanium, and I thought, and because I'm an inventor, I build things that aren't on the shelf, I have to know all these welding techniques, how to weld plastic, how to weld aluminum, how to weld all these things. So I have these toys in my shop, right? I went to try to get a Brown's gas machine, and they were $100,000.
Unbelievable.
So as an inventor, what I did is I just gathered together every bit of research that I could on Brown's gas, and I put together a research study and wrote what's called the Brown's Gas Book 1, but then ended up and sold that through my business. And that put me in contact with hundreds of people who had experience with Brown's gas in various ways. Those people got back to me, and I put together the information that they were bringing back to me in another research thing, along with essentially my own ideas of the capacitive power supply, and built a very simple, extremely efficient, has been independently tested over 98% efficiency electrolyzer. And the this particular electrolyzer design, like NASA, even with high pressures and exotic materials, high temperatures, is not getting 98% electrolysis.
Isn't that something? Now, are you using straight DC to accomplish that?
No, the we're using the pulsed DC. Now, we're just taking it directly from the wall. It's a very, very, very simple thing. We're just in using a full-wave bridge rectifier and getting essentially 120 pulses per second, but pulsed DC. The idea is to, as soon as you pulse through, start the bubbles on the plate, release the energy, and allow the bubbles to get off the plate. It's one of the things that helps us get the maximum efficiency. If you use straight DC, the bubbles on the plate becomes a layer that the electricity has to try to go through, a resistance, in order to make more bubbles, right?
Yes.
Okay. So what we're doing is...
you're allowing time for the bubbles to move.
Right. We wrote Brown's Gas Book 1, and because of all of this research and all the, that I was doing and the stuff that came out from before, we ended up being able to write Brown's Gas Book 2. And the Brown's Gas Book 2 tells how to build these highly efficient electrolyzers in any size. And actually, if you build an electrolyzer from our Brown's Gas Book 2, it will be 5% more efficient than the electrolyzers we actually sell. Because there's certain things that we had to, in order to have a commercial machine, we had to put holes in the plates so that the fluid could go back and forth and what have you, and it reduced the electrolysis efficiency by a small amount. And so if people want the most efficient electrolyzers in the world, all they have to do is just build them right from our plans where we tell everything you need to know to build the Brown's Gas electrolyzers.
Okay, and these prices that you have on these publications are reasonable. Brown's Gas Book 2, according to this list that I'm looking at here, is only, what, is this only $20-some dollars? Is that right?
$24 for the Brown's Gas Book 2, yes.
Yeah.
And that has the plans so you can build what we now call water torches.
Right. So
now, the reason we call it a water torch is because a lot of the people out there, there's 20 different companies building Brown's Gas machines. Now, they name them various other kinds of things, but a lot of them call them water welders. And although you can weld with these particular machines, you weld it as a torch. Like if you're using oxyacetylene welding,
right,
welding or brazing tip, then you're welding. You're not calling, you're calling it a torch, not a welder, right?
Right.
So that's why we call our things a water torch, because it has to do with the flame. It's always important to remember that welders, like in an arc welder, for example, can weld better than any flame, including Brown's Gas flame. Now,
yes.
Brown's Gas flame can weld better than any other flame in the world.
Yes, most people aren't using a flame to weld with.
Exactly. They're using arc techniques of one kind or another. But they are using a flame to braze, solder, sinter, polish, cut, all the things you use a flame for.
Well, even to heat parts, just to take things apart and so on.
Is superior, that's right. So anyway, with the Brown's Gas, we were able to build these super efficient water torches, and then eventually that morphed into the what we call the Hyzor technology, because after I'd written the Water as Fuel Book 1, one of the first things that we did was write two additional books called the Hyzor Technology and Water Injection, because we had this super efficient electrolyzer design, and we were able to build it into something small enough that we'd be able to put into a vehicle. Like in the Hyzor technology book, it actually is a round chamber kind of thing, and it's relatively large because that's the experimentation kind of thing that we were doing then. But then I had some innovative ideas on how to build this same high efficiency into just plastic plumbing pipe. Now I have specific ones that fit with the metal pieces I have inside and what have you, but we were able to build these electrolyzers at a low enough cost that people could actually then have a kit, which is typically what's been happening. I don't patent anything. I don't believe in it. It has to do with my philosophy back from the beginning, where with the carburetor enhancer, I actually approached fulfillment companies where I'd say, here's an idea that for $15 people can, and that's $15 retail, people can, because you can buy the parts for like on wholesale thing like for $5, right?
Right.
So the you can, for $15 and about an hour's worth of work, 75% of the vehicles will get at least a 25% gain. This seemed like a pretty good thing to me. They took one look at it, and they told me, and I got this from several, we won't sell it because it's too simple. Anybody can do it in their backyard.
Yeah. So in other words, major problems in the world are allowed to continue to worsen, you know, environmental problems and so on, things
right.
that you've already mentioned also,
yep.
economic problems and so on, because of something, and that's a pretty dumb excuse for not promoting a technology that's
it had to do with their making money. They wanted control.
Yeah.
So what I did is I went the opposite way. I can't give you the exact way of thinking I had, but I decided, okay, if everybody can do it in their backyard, these people aren't doing it, what can I do as a farm boy, essentially? I had $20 in my pocket kind of thing. What I did is I wrote up a little set of plans, and actually I was going to school at the time, so I used the school's computer to write up a little set of plans in a book and hand drawings, and there was a company called Carb Research Center, which, in addition to my own mail-order business I was getting started, promoted my carburetor enhancer book. My carburetor enhancer book sold 100-to-1 to any other books that he was selling.
Wow.
Because of the royalties I got from that, I was able to buy my own computer. That was my first Macintosh. And eventually, that's how I got my wife, because I met on an online dating service, and she's an amazing woman. She actually helped me make my business, and she's the business side of my, or the smart
yeah,
side,
in fact, I've communicated
side.
With her for this interview. You and I have never actually spoken prior to this this call.
That's right. She was doing all the business, the organization, getting it arranged for this particular thing. That's right.
And that's great. She deserves a lot of credit for being your support in the business.
Well, that's the thing, is that an inventor like myself, generally speaking, have very little people skills. And we're good with the physical stuff, and the kind of the more genius you are on that side, it's almost like an idiot savant. But she is big time on the other side. She's got the relationship skills, the business savvy, everything. So it really works well.
Yeah,
so anyway, she redesigned my books and made them into something you could actually read, which you have copies of in your hand. I don't think I sent you any of my... No, I definitely didn't send you any of my original papers. But the point of the matter is we were able to help over 100,000 people put on these carburetor enhancers.
Wow.
And obviously, they were very good, and that essentially made the business. Now, what we're going to do, my wife's 84 Honda Civic, for example, with the Heiser system and a few of these other technologies I have on, is getting close to 60 miles to the gallon, and it's an 84. Now, the hybrids today are hardly getting that.
Yeah, exactly.
So the thing is, extreme mileage... That isn't what I call extreme mileage. I just call that high mileage. But the point of the matter is you can get a whole lot better mileage. People can essentially double their mileage with these technologies. It's getting better mileage than it was when it was new.
And that always translates to less pollution coming out the tailpipe.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And cooler exhaust temperatures and longer running engine, because you don't have the carbon buildups and all of that kind of thing. I just thought I'd mention fairly quickly, just in case we're going to be running out of time here, that I'm offering a 15% discount in our e-store for anybody who is listening to your radio blog here.
Oh, great.
If they put in this particular code,
uh-huh.
they'll get a 15% discount. Now, code comes right kind of at the end when they're paying. There's a place where they can put in the code. The code is BTR, as in Blog Talk Radio,
okay.
5507.
BTR5507.
And that's all caps, BTR5507.
Very good. And that's, again, at eagle-research.com.
That's right. And up in the upper right-hand corner of any page on the site, it says order, and you click on that, and it'll go to the e-store. So you can.
Well, that's nice. That's a nice provision.
Products.
Well, your prices are reasonable enough that no one should be, you know, scratching around for a discount, but that is a very nice gesture.
Excellent. We try to help people save money, which is what it come down to is that I actually build these things for myself, literally. If I didn't sell a single one, that'd be fine. The discount is for the water as fuel and brown gas products only.
Fine.
Okay. So the I build the things for myself. I don't patent them. I don't control it in any way such a form like that. I make the manuals to tell people exactly how to do it, and then eventually after we sold a bunch of manuals and fine-tuned, because when it goes out there, the customers actually become part of the research team, if you will, because I can't do everything myself. I've got my own vehicles. I test it on friends' vehicles. I'm a gifted mechanic. I can do well, but you can't test in every situation.
And so you're interested in feedback from the customers.
Oh, I love it.
And I see some excellent testimonials here.
Yes, we have a whole box full. We just haven't gotten them up on the site.
Well, here's a pretty interesting one here from a guy in Tennessee, 103% mileage increase.
Yes.
Using the carb enhancer.
Yes.
And there's another one here that mentions a 12 mile per gallon to 24.5 miles per gallon with the HiCo.
Yep.
Here's one, a 71% improvement using the Hizor from 21 miles per gallon to 36.2 miles per gallon.
Yep. Yep. So there's a lot of really good results happening out there. Now those of course are the exceptionally high ones, which generally speaking I don't quote. Some of the people out there doing combustion enhancement or fuel savers will tell what the best thing that they possibly could do. But we're doing it the other way. We tell what most people can get. And that's why I say, for example, if you're going with the Hizor system or the HiCo system, you're looking for 25%. If you can figure you can, at 25%, pay for itself, then go for it. You'll be happy. And most people will get at least that.
Now, you're not selling, then, the finished products. You're not selling a kit that can be installed on a vehicle. Is that correct?
Yes, we are. We are as well.
Oh, you are now. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. The Hizor technology, what we have is the Hizor basic kit, ER Hizor basic kit. And because my wife got involved in this, she took it past the techie backyard guy, like she... She could hardly read my books when I first put them out because I knew stuff. And somebody who knows stuff shouldn't be writing the manual on it.
Yeah.
They should always have, and I have this wonderful woman here who happens to have exceptional editorial skills.
Yeah, and who translated into common.
That's right, common speak, to the point where we actually have videos. Our video that shows how to put the Hizor on is done with a young lady who's only 21 years old, and she isn't a mechanic, and she follows the instructions of the video, installs successfully on her father's truck, actually father's truck, and a friend of her father's vehicle, both of them which are getting exceptional mileage. And so I'm not even going to tell you what it is, because it's better than average. And so the little young lady in the video become a Hizor installer just by watching the video.
Okay, so if a person wants to, they can get the information and build these devices themselves using the guidelines that you give, or they can buy the actual kit that they would then install in their vehicle.
That's right. So you can buy the manual, which tells you about everything you need to know to just build it yourself, where to get the parts, everything. So the or you can just buy the parts from us and build it yourself kind of thing as well.
Right. And if a person's not mechanically inclined but they want to do this, they can have a mechanic watch the video or read up and then install the device that you sell them.
Absolutely. No problem.
Yeah. So that's excellent. And like you say, it can be paid for in a short time because of the fuel savings.
Exactly.
And a person can feel better knowing that they have gone beyond the call and reducing
and we're, and we're putting on a fuel-saving calculator on the website, too, things like that. For example, this five-year money-saving calculator, if your fuel cost is $50 a week, I'm just taking figures out of the air here, and you drive 52 weeks a year, it, at a 25% fuel savings, you would actually save $4,212.12 in 5 years.
Wow.
So the, and of course you would have spent initially, if you hadn't saved any fuel at all, almost $17,000 in fuel. So this is significant. People don't realize how much it is, although every time they go to the fuel pumps and pay $50 for a tank of gas, and it keeps going up.
Yeah, there's no telling how far it's going to go either.
Exactly. So from the beginning of any particular five-year period, like I've averaged over 20-year time period that there's an average of a 13% increase in fuel price every year. And as the fuel, we've already gone over the peak, so as fuel continues to get more expensive, it's because what we've done is used up all or most of the cheap oil. We're a long ways from running out of oil. But we are almost out of cheap oil. So as the price of oil continues to go up, it will get more and more expensive at more than 13% a year. Now, Europeans, of course, are paying twice as what as much as North Americans. And Canadians, interestingly enough, even though they are an oil-exporting nation, are paying about 30% more for their fuel than Americans.
Yeah, isn't that funny?
Yeah, isn't it funny?
I mean, not funny, it's terrible.
Yeah,
Canadians are always complaining to me about that. Their dollar doesn't go as far, and, you know, it's
exactly.
Seems like someone's really taking it out on them.
I just wanted to mention as well, if I may, that we have what's called an events page on the Eagle Research site,
yeah,
where people can kind of go and save more info and what have you. And if people look at that, they'll actually see mini demos of the Brown's Gas mini demo to look at actual water torches and ask questions about all the different technologies and things that can happen with that. And then there's the Hyzor demos where people can come and actually get hands-on information about the onboard electrolyzer technology. And that's definitely the water as fuel. I think we've got the leading edge because, for example, if you examine all the other electrolyzers out there, and I call them my peers, I don't call them competition. These guys are doing well. I'd actually like to put together an organization and that combines their expertises and starts getting the best of the best out there. So in any case, if they go to this page, what we call the events page or more news, they'll be able to see with these various demonstrations. I've been invited to speak in October at the Nexus conference in Brisbane. And so we're trying to fit that in as well. So anybody who happens to listen to you from Australia.
Well, that sounds good. Yeah. Well, let me ask you, though. We only have a few minutes left.
Yes.
There has been some mention of the composition of Brown's gas, and in reading some of your publications, you acknowledge that things aren't the same with every electrolyzer and every batch of gas that you produce. There seems to be there are differences, and I think Andrew Makrowski made reference to Brown's gas as being a soup. In other words, it really is composed of different percentages of different gases based on what went in and what was done to produce the gas, the exact type of waveform and so on. And what do you have to say about that? What have you found in your research as far as...
That is an excellent question and more or less along the lines of what I was just... one of the things I was going to focus on with the water as fuel. Obviously, this particular answer has applicability in any electrolyzer design. But our Hyzors, and one of the reasons I think we're leading edge, is that for as little as 5 amps, we get the same mileage gain that people out there doing 30, even 100 amps. Like if you're looking at, there's been a thing on the YouTube where there was a person had batteries in his trunk and he was running 150 amps of current through an electrolyzer and getting about a 25% gain in his mileage. We can get a 25% gain with 5 amps because of the quality of the gas.
Okay, so there is an issue of quality of gas. Not all these gases are created equal, in other words.
That's correct. And if you understand the combustion characteristics, why Brown's gas actually increases the combustion efficiency of carbon-based fuels, you know that you don't need a lot of it. Okay, so what you need is the highest quality gas with the least amount of amperage, because every watt of Brown's gas that you put in, you actually use 7 watts of fuel to make because of the inefficiencies of the alternator and the combustion engine and that sort of thing. So with this particular thing, you want to get the highest quality gas at the least amount of amperage that you can get, and that's the kind of thing we're doing. Now, the components, the constituents of Brown's gas include, I found 6 different constituents. We've got diatomic hydrogen and oxygen, which every physicist would say you have because you're splitting water into hydrogen and oxygen, and that's what they're used to seeing in bottled gases. You've got a component of water vapor, which is still water, obviously, but any water that's associated with a gas is going to put some water. If you have liquid water anywhere around, you can have some water vapor in the gas, right?
Right.
Then you've got, now this is what physicists say can't happen, you have a significant portion, and up to 3%, some as low as 1 and up to 3%, of what's called monatomic, or straight H and straight O. It's not diatomic, H2 and O2. And then you have a final constituent. The sixth constituent is what I call electrically expanded water, and Santilli is calling magnecules. It's what Ewell Brown called a fluid crystal. And what it is a gaseous form of water, which is not steam. Okay, it's an electrically expanded water.
And it's not combustible.
It's definitely combustible.
But if you put a match to it, it won't burn.
It will implode. Okay, it'll go directly down to water.
Without exploding.
Sure. Now, since Brown's gas is mostly diatomic hydrogen and oxygen, you are going to get an explosion. It just won't be as sharp as an explosion as if it was the straight bottled hydrogen and oxygen.
Now, are you able to isolate this gas?
No, not yet. We're still working on that.
No one's ever succeeded in isolating it?
Not to my knowledge.
So that's why Mikrowski used the word soup. In other words, you have this mix of gases, and it seems strange to me that the academia has not really focused on this. I don't know that there's any real in-depth research that's been done. Do you know of any?
We are looking at research of these sort of things now that we have an idea what to look for.
But as far as
I can't say
volume that exists in university libraries or bookstores for chemistry, electrochemistry, does anyone really have a handle on this?
Not yet.
And doesn't that seem surprising to you?
I would say that Santilli has the closest handle on actually finding, being able to measure the gas with the work that he's doing.
Gas chromatography or whatever you
call
it?
Chromatography, that's right.
Yeah. But it does seem funny that all these decades after chemistry seems to have, you know, quantified everything, that they still don't have electrolysis down.
That's true. There's a lot of things about water that people don't understand. There's hours of blog radio on that. So could I mention the, just before we sign off, the code again just for people?
Yeah, please do.
Okay, so it's all caps, B, as Boy Tom Roger, BTR, 5507. So people can get the 15% off the Waters, Fuel, and Brown's gas stuff.
And again, at Eagle...
At eagle-research.com.
Mm-hmm.
And also, there's interesting stuff over at watertorch.com if you want to check into the Brown's gas with water torches more.
Great. And what I'd like to do, if you don't mind, if we could do a follow-up to this program and talk more about the subject of implosion, more about the constitution of the gases that come out, and the different things you've found as you've experimented with it over the years.
It would be my pleasure.
Well, it sounds great. I appreciate your being a guest on this program. I'm sure many people benefit from your expressions, and hopefully you'll see an increase in traffic on your site as a result.
Well, that's always a nice side benefit. We're looking to help people. I've done it for myself, and what I'm trying to do is share.
Yeah, and it's obvious that you have the best interests of this planet and its future generations at heart as well.
That's what it takes. I'm only here for a short time.
Yeah, well, we all need to have a similar mindset, and that's why I thought you were a worthy guest for this program. I appreciate it. Thank you so much, and I thank everyone for joining us.
Good night.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.